The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. International Overdose Awareness Day was August 31st. The organization Broken No More held a news conference August 27th to uplift the voices of families who've lost loved ones to the toxic, unregulated drug supply and to drug overdose. We'll hear some of those voices in a moment. But first, resistance to the militarization of domestic policing and the ongoing federal assault on communities and working people continues to grow. Organizers and activists gathered in Washington, D.C. on August 28th for a Labor Day rally and march as part of solidarity season. Let's hear some of that. First, here's Samuel Epps, president of the Metropolitan Washington Council of the AFL-CIO. He introduces Otis Johnson, Jr., national vice president of the 14th District of the American Federation of Government Employees.
When I say people, you say power. People.
Power.
People.
Power.
When I say union, you say power. Union.
Power.
Union.
Power.
When I say free, you say D.C. Free.
D.C.
Free. Free!
DC.
Free!
DC.
That's right. That is what we're here today to discuss. People power, union power, and a free DC. My name is Sam Epps. I'm the president of Metropolitan Washington Council, AFL-CIO. We are the federation of more than 150 local unions here in D.C. and the five counties in Maryland, representing over 150,000 workers across every industry in this city. And before anything else, are there union members with us here today?
Yeah.
Are there union members here today?
Yeah.
To my siblings in the labor movement, it is an honor, as always, to be with you today and take action together. In addition, I want to name and uplift council affiliates who are here today. AFSCME, Council 20.
Yeah!
AFGE, District 14.
Yeah!
ATU, 689.
Yeah!
National Nurses United.
Yeah!
MPEU.
Yeah!
SEIU Local 500.
Yeah!
1199 SEIU. 32BJ, USCW Local 400, the Washington Teachers Union, the Coalition of Labor Union Women, and the Maryland DC Alliance for Retired Americans, as well as AFA, APFA, NEA, NFFE, and SEIU International, along with Unite Here, Local 25 and 23. Let's give it up for our labor movement. But we're not here just alone. We're here with our community partners, Free DC, and many other partners out there. Thank you for, absolutely, thank you for being here. Unions are the heart of the labor movement, but if you work for a living, you're a worker, and you're a part of the labor movement too. It's going to take all of us, union members, allies, to win in this moment. We are here today to kick off solidarity season. Yeah. Workers over billionaires.
Yeah.
And also we're here because 62 years ago today, over 500,000 Americans, civil rights leaders, faith leaders, community groups, marched in this city. We are direct descendants of that fight and that struggle. And today we bring that into this circle together to fight on behalf of those who have not, who have been attacked under this administration. And right now, the Trump administration is causing D.C. to have the highest unemployment rate in the nation. D.C. leads the nation in unemployment for the third month in a row, and that's a direct cause of this administration. To all the federal workers who are here today, we see you, we appreciate you, And you deserve better than you have been treated. Right now, the Trump administration has stripped collective bargaining rights from thousands of public sector union members in our region. Public sector workers process Social Security checks, keep our food safe, develop life-saving medicines, and so much more. They deserve protection on their job, but the Trump administration is directly attacking it. And right now, the Trump administration is making it more dangerous for all of us to go to work. This is not safety. No one should be getting arrested at their job as a delivery driver. No one should be getting asked for papers at a traffic checkpoint or on the metro. What is happening in D.C. is wrong, period. And anyone, any elected official who says otherwise, it is wrong. You are on the wrong side of workers and on the wrong side of history. In the labor movement, though, we're going up against people who refuse to respect us. Like any bad boss, we know ways to stop Trump and his agenda, and that is through collective action. And that's why we're here today. And we're going to hear more about this from some incredible speakers today. And to start us off, I am proud to introduce Otis Johnson, the Executive Vice President of AFSCME District 14.
AFGE. When we fight,
we win.
When we fight,
we win.
Now let me talk to you about what we're seeing right here in Washington, D.C. today. The federalization of police, the National Guard on our streets. We all care about safety. We live here. We work here. We raise our families here. But let's be real. D.C. is not the crime-infested city this administration wants us to believe. That storyline is definitely a distraction. It's meant to scare people, divide workers, and pull our attention away from the real issues that matter to the members. It will not work, not today, not on our watch. Our mission is simple and powerful. Respect for the job, fair pay, safe workplaces, due processes, real telework that works, dignity for every federal and D.C. government worker who keeps this country running. That is what we bargain for. That is what we organize for. That is what we win. Good afternoon, my brothers and sisters that are here today with us. I'm proud to stand with the members and leaders here. To every federal and D.C. government worker in this crowd and every ally standing with us, hear me and hear me clearly. AFGE will always fight with our members, fight for our members. We have your backs today, tomorrow, and every day after that. This administration can throw roadblocks. They can sign executive orders. They can try to box us out. We will not flinch. Whatever they throw at us, we're going to throw it back at them and throw it even harder. And what's good about it, they're not going to see it coming. Because we fight smart. We fight together. We fight with the law. We fight with the facts and with our solidarity. See, they want headlines. We want results. They want photo ops. We want contracts that lift people up. They want us to be quiet, but we're just gonna get louder. So here's what I'm asking from you. Contact your congressional and council leaders. Connect with your locals. Show up for bargaining, testify, volunteer, bring two co-workers to the next rally and to your next meeting. If your rights are violated, call us. We'll be there to help you. Because if they come for one of us, And they will meet all of us. When we fight,
we win.
When we fight,
we win.
Brothers and sisters, keep your head lifted up. We've been through shutdowns. We've been through furloughs, hiring freezes, and cuts. And guess what? We're still here. We're still strong. And we're not going anywhere. To the administration, hear this loud and clear. Respect the workers who make America work. Because we are ready. We are organized, and we are coming. Thank you. Let's get back to work. Let's go win and release those Epstein files.
That was Otis Johnson Jr., National Vice President of the 14th District of the American Federation of Government Employees. Before him, you heard Samuel Epps, President of the Metropolitan Washington Council of the AFL-CIO. They spoke August 28th at a Labor Day rally and march in Washington, D.C.
And now we're out in the streets. Out in the streets. Out in the streets.
Yeah.
Out in the streets. Ain't gonna let no fascists take our democracy.
Well, we went down to Whole Foods.
Well, we went down to the Whole Foods.
And we
what? Took back what they stole from us.
Took it back.
Took back our dignity.
Took it back.
Took back our humanity.
Well, we
went down to the Whole Foods and we took back what they stole from us.
Took it back.
Took back our dignity.
Took it back.
Took back our humanity.
And now we're out in the streets.
Out in the streets. Out in the streets.
Yeah.
Out in the streets.
Hey,
ain't gonna let no billionaires take our democracy.
Yeah.
You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, International Overdose Awareness Day was August 31st. The organization Broken No More held a news conference August 27th to lift up the voices of families who've lost loved ones to the toxic unregulated drug supply and to drug overdose. Let's hear some of them. First, here's Tamara Ault, MD, Executive Director of Broken No More. She'll introduce the first speaker, Kimberly Douglas, founder of Black Moms Against Overdose.
This is my 14th Overdose Awareness Day, speaking, advocating, grieving. I lost my son, Josh, at the age of 16 in 2012 to a heroin overdose. He died from shame, stigma, silence. He used alone in his bedroom, overdose, aspirated, and died on the way to the hospital. He died from a completely preventable tragedy, which is overdose. And we're here in remembrance of all those we've lost, but also to stand up and say, we're not going to just sit in a corner and cry and mourn our children, but we're going to do something about it. I don't want someone to be me. I don't want someone 14 years, 14 birthdays, 14 Christmases, watching my son's friends have babies and get married, and he's still 16. He's in high school. He missed his prom the week after he died. So I do all this out of love, out of love for all the families out there who have a potential to lose someone, and to prevent other people from being us. All us speakers here today, and so many hundreds of thousands of families throughout our country. Today, I'm here in the capacity as executive director of GRASP, Broken No More. GRASP stands for Grief Recovery After Substance Passing, and we're a peer-led group that supports families, parents, children, spouses who've lost someone to overdose, because it's a very isolating grief. It's misunderstood, and people don't know the special circumstances that we deal with after losing someone to overdose. The Broken No More part of our group, which is really who is kind of sponsoring this along with Vital Strategies today, deals with drug policy and education. We want sane drug policies. We want drug policies that focus on health and education. And we take a step back from criminalization, from the failed war on drugs, which we know after billions of dollars, 40 years of incarcerating people, putting them in cages, shoving them into back alleys, it doesn't work. We have good scientific-backed evidence that criminalization is not the answer. So we're here to stand up today and say enough and to advocate for the things that work, like harm reduction, naloxone distribution, healthcare, dignity, respect, all the things that will keep our people alive, engage them in care, and engage them to care about themselves and to take care of each other. But when we create stigma and judgment, we push people into a black market for drugs. We push them into spaces where they can't ask for help, where they don't feel comfortable, where they know they're going to be turned away, they're going to be judged, and so more will die. So we're here to stand up for positive change as it relates to our drug policy, positive change as it relates to people who use drugs, because it's really the only way forward. I'm also the founder of Jolt Harm Reduction, and we went from distributing just naloxone on the streets to whoever I could get to take it, putting together kits on my dining room table, going around crying and begging people to take naloxone, to a fully functioning harm reduction program, including syringe access, drug checking, recovery services. But it's been a battle every step of the way. And we're seeing throughout the country, syringe access services are being cut down, funding is being slashed. Things that we know will save lives are being thrown out. So it's enough about me, but you know why I'm here and why this matters so much to me. And I will hopefully always continue this fight, always with my son standing behind me. I know what he would want. He was a kind, generous, amazing soul. And I know he'd want us to do this work. I know he'd want us to be their voices, because our children don't have a voice anymore. We are their voice, and we're here to make change. So I will turn this over to our first speaker, Kimberly Douglas, who lost her 17-year-old son, Bryce, and she is the founder of Black Moms Against Overdose. And Kimberly is from Maryland. Thank you, Kimberly.
Thank you, Tammy. Thank you, Gloria. I'm happy to be here today. I'm just not happy for the circumstances in which why I'm here, but I'm happy to be on the panel with you all. In June of 2023, I lost my 17-year-old son, Bryce, to fentanyl poisoning. He died just a month after graduating high school and only 5 days before his 18th birthday. Bryce was loving, kind, smart, funny, and creative. He loved to listen to music, draw pictures, watch anime, play video games, skateboard, and hang out with his friends. As a young child, Bryce was diagnosed with ADHD, so growing up, he was used to taking medication daily. During the pandemic, my family and I realized that he began to experiment, first with over-the-counter drugs, then with marijuana, and then when school opened back up, him and a group of friends began to experiment with pills. After Bryce passed, I looked for other mothers who had lost children to overdose. Talking helped with the emptiness, but I often found that I was the only mother, or the only Black mother, rather, in the room, and often the only one questioning harmful drug policies. Too many grieving families are encouraged to support drug-induced homicide laws, not realizing that those laws disproportionately harm Black and Brown communities. My family and I later learned that the person who sold Bryce the fake Percocet was likely a friend, just a 15-year-old young man, Black boy. I'm heartbroken and I'm angry, but I don't believe locking up a 15-year-old is the answer. Punishment won't bring my son back. It will only add more harm to a system that is already broken. We're in the middle of the worst overdose crisis in history. Nearly 80,000 lives are lost to overdose every year. And on International Overdose Awareness Day, we come together and remember our loved ones to honor their lives and to demand real solutions. Right now, some politicians and law enforcement are using this crisis to push the same old failed drug war policies, like long mandatory sentences and drug-induced homicide charges. These do not save lives. They fill prisons, they target Black and poor communities, and they make the overdose crisis worse. Our prisons are full of people who need healing, not punishment. Black people and poor communities are far more likely to be criminalized instead of offered care. We cannot arrest our way out of this crisis. Grieving for any family is difficult, but grieving as a Black mom has been lonely and heavy. In our culture, just like in other people of color cultures, we just don't talk about it. We're expected to be strong, to carry it all, but strength should not mean silence. Our grief is real and it deserves space. We cannot stay silent anymore. That's why I started Black Moms Against Overdose, a space where Black mothers can grieve openly, support one another, and fight stigma. We share our stories because our voices matter and because silence does not save lives. Addiction and overdose are moral failures. They are health issues. Every family should feel safe talking about them and seeking help. Families like mine don't want more punishment. We want compassion, care, and proven solutions. We will keep showing up, keep speaking out, and keep reminding lawmakers that the drug war has failed. We won't let them repeat it again. Sadly, my baby boy Bryce will never walk back through my front door, but I will keep fighting so that other families don't have to feel this pain. My grief has a purpose now, to turn pain into action and to replace punishment with compassion.
That was Kimberly Douglas, founder of Black Moms Against Overdose. Before her, you heard Tamara Ault, MD, executive director of Broken No More. They were speaking August 27th at a news conference held by Broken No More. Now, here's Jesse Dunleavy.
I did lose my son to overdose, and I realized then that his death was preventable. My overwhelming grief catapulted me into studying the forces at play. I wasn't driven by revenge, but by just a need to understand. So I read journals and books and reached out to thought leaders in the country, scientists, journalists, researchers, many of whom surprised me by taking time to answer my questions. And I joined organizations, I attended national conferences, and I testified, and I still do. I've done it for years now. My son Paul was different. He struggled all of his life with neurological differences. There was no label for his condition, despite the multiple professional evaluations that I saw. Among his handicaps were a language impairment and a hand tremor, both of which kept him from expressing himself in school. So his ability to communicate was compromised, and he went through school in special education and for the most part was misunderstood and underestimated. He had an abundant capacity for empathy, and he was intuitive and sweet. But his word retrieval was so slow that he was reluctant to join in a group conversation, so he was socially awkward. His teachers adored him, characterizing him as sensitive and kind, but he was trapped inside of himself and capable of higher level reasoning than he could ever demonstrate. He was very close to me and our family, but otherwise he didn't have a lot of peer interaction. As he grew older, he was marginalized, and he was aware that he was bullied, he was a target, and his deep-seated feelings of inadequacy grew. He turned to drugs in his 20s, and it was never a social thing. I know now full well that it was masking his pain, and how very sad it is for all of our children whose discovery of a drug at first hides that persistent pain. It dulls it. And it seems like an opportunity to join others and to move forward, and it gives you new hope. And the tragedy is, it's the beginning of the road to more suffering than you ever knew beforehand. Throughout his life, he was treated by healthcare professionals, but that came to a screeching halt when he was incarcerated at one point. And during that time, it was a nightmare. He was hungry consistently. He was robbed. And then, because he was always the target, he was sexually abused. When he got out, he was despondent. He felt worse about himself than ever before. Plus, he couldn't find employment. After many, many discouraging years, he finally got on the right track. He got a job that he loved, and he was happy. He had his first apartment, but he relapsed. And he turned to me, and together we sought help. But we struck out at every turn. So at this point, I know that our priority as a nation has to be on the people who are suffering. If you think about all the people who are involved in this crisis that we're facing, from the people who suffer with addiction to families, to treatment providers, to legislators, who is it that needs the most help? Who is it that's at risk of dying? We need to focus on them. It just seems so much common sense to me. And harm reduction initiatives do just that. They prioritize those who suffer. And they afford them the dignity they deserve and the health care that they need. So beyond the crucial component of keeping people alive, these initiatives also instill in people the incentive to work toward a better life. And that paves the way to recovery. Simply put, we cannot continue our failed practices of disempowering those that are most at risk, of removing resources from them and isolating them and making it harder for them to take care of themselves. Shaming people only pushes them into back alleys. Isolating them increases their chances of using alone and dying. The drug war has brought us crime, violence, dangerous substances, and racial inequity. We need to do everything possible to eradicate the inequality by ending the practice of arrests that target the already marginalized. Make no mistake, the drug war has also created our biggest barrier, and that's stigma. And it's stigma that's fueled and normalized oppression. And it's a huge culprit, but we will never overcome it as long as we criminalize the behavior that we're trying to destigmatize. So I've never understood why we're comfortable with jails and prisons where dehumanization is the norm and downright abuse is routine, but we're uncomfortable with evidence-based healthcare that has proven beyond question to reduce deaths while bolstering the likelihood of recovery. How do we get legislative buy-in for the life-saving, health-centered policies? Our challenges right now seem greater than ever, but it's all the more reason to keep up our efforts to promote common sense, proven initiatives. And so in Paul's name, I pray every day for a breakthrough in greater understanding. Thank you so much.
That was Jesse Dunleavy speaking August 27th at a news conference held by the organization Broken No More. You can find the Broken No More website at broken-no-more.org. That's broken-no-more.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port service. Please support public media and local community radio. Become members. Become volunteers. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.